Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape has everything you need when it comes to John Deere. They got tractors, mowers, implements, full parts and service, you name it. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call at 530-226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And there you have it.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to keep the foolishness to a minimum today because we're talking about climate science with someone who actually knows things about climate science, which is exciting because there is so much misinformation out there about that. It just seems to never end. So the timing is excellent for us to chat with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry. She is president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She's a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit more. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and prediction predictability. Curry is a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. Following an influential career in academic research and administration, Curry founded CFAN to translate cutting-edge weather and climate research into forecast products and services. Sorry, we are going to talk about politics too. Forecast products and services that support the management of weather and climate risk for public and private sector decision makers. Curry is a leading global thinker on climate change. She's frequently called upon to give U.S. congressional testimony and serve as an expert witness on matters related to weather and climate. Her influential blog, Climate Etc., addresses leading-edge and controversial topics about climate change and science policy interface. Her new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking the Climate Change Problem, The Risks We Are Facing and How We Can Respond, is available now. And we've given you links at wethepeopleradio.us. You can find this interview this afternoon. It is actually Sunday, October 1st, when we're airing this the first time, and I'm positive we'll air this again. But just for, you know, perspective, it's October 1st, 2023 at this particular time. And links to her book, links to her her Twitter. Just can't do the X thing. It's still Twitter. To her Twitter connection and her blog, judithcurry.com, is her website. So judithcurry.com. Super simple and easy to find. And I've watched several, Bill and I both did, we watched several YouTube interviews with Dr. Curry. And the more we watched, the more we were like, okay, we know all this stuff is kind of, we know they're making a lot of it up, but we don't have any proof. She's got all the proof. So we're going to let her do the bulk of the talking because, well, she knows all of this. Dr. Curry, we appreciate you spending your Sunday afternoon with us.
Hello, Aaron. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. We couldn't help but laugh every interview somehow. Always had to highlight the fact that you're a climate
denier,
which of course we get called that all the time, but you're a climate disinformation purveyor or something. What was the other one they call you? I was like, that's a new one. I guess if you're a scientist, you get a better name, huh?
Well, you know, a little bit of backstory on that. This isn't about science or my take on the science of climate change. Things went south for me in 2010 when I started criticizing the climate community for their behavior, and this was following the ClimateGate emails. I don't know if you. Okay, so I started raising issues about saying we need to make all of our data publicly available. We need to be transparent in our methods. We need to be more honest and open about the uncertainties. And we need to be more respectful of people who disagree with us.
And well, that would make you a heretic for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that did it. And it really got bad when I started criticizing the hockey stick. And then that's when all the denier and serial climate disinformer and all those names started. And it's very little to do with the actual substance of climate science. I certainly have a much broader perspective than what you'll get from the IPCC. But nothing that I'm saying is, you know, outside of the range of what should be considered here. It's really more about the social dynamics of the climate community and their perceived need to present a united front so that they can influence policymaking and so that their research will be well funded.
Well, we hear that all the time that the science is settled, and I'm 62, so I was in sixth grade a long time ago, but I remember in sixth grade something to the effect that science is never settled. I mean,
you were taught well in the sixth grade. Okay, I mean, you know, there's a few obvious facts here, you know, surrounding climate change. Yes, temperatures have been increasing for more than 100 years. Yes, humans emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Yes, carbon dioxide has an infrared emission spectra and therefore acts to warm the planet, all other things being equal. However, the most consequential issues about whether CO2-driven warming has dominated over natural climate variability, how the climate of the 21st century will play out, whether climate change is dangerous. These are the most consequential issues, and there's a great deal of disagreement and uncertainty that the important people are trying to sweep under the rug.
Yeah, because in one of them you had said, like, basically there are unknowns about what's unknown. I mean, it's just there's a lot of this that isn't so easy to pin down, and it isn't as simplistic as they would like to paint it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the climate system is exceedingly complex. And, you know, simplistic notions of more research reduces the uncertainty. Well, it doesn't work that way. It just seems to add more dimensions of things that we had previously neglected that we now need to consider. So the complexity continues, you know, our perception of the complexity of all this is ever growing.
we haven't,
you know, come close to reaching, you know, peak understanding or peak identification of all the factors that might be involved. So, I mean, and we get surprises all the time. The bad surprises get highlighted in the media.
Right.
Okay, but anything good, unexpectedly good, or on the cold side, of course, gets completely ignored. So you get this one.
It just doesn't fit the
view of what's going on.
Yeah, it doesn't.
And we have
doesn't
unprecedented
fit the narrative that they're trying to drill us with.
Oh, yeah, and you know, the simplistic idea that they're trying to frighten us into urgently, you know, reducing our use of fossil fuels. Well, you know, if the climate change is really going to be bad, you know, I don't think that it is, but let's say for a minute that they're right. the worst thing that we could do is cripple our energy system and supply, and so that we have inadequate and irregular energy supplies, so we can't stay warm in the winter. We can't run the desalination plants when we need them, and so forth and so on. So electricity and energy is the foundation for keeping us safe from extreme weather and climate events. So the last thing we should be doing is messing with our electricity supply I'm not saying that we shouldn't advance and try to build a better 21st century infrastructure, but this imperative to kneecap the fossil fuel industry before we have proven replacements is a really dangerous strategy.
Well, and coming up with these arbitrary, I'm sure as a scientist, the word arbitrary probably is kind of like the F word for you guys, but you know, come up with these arbitrary goals. By this magical date, we're going to get rid of this amount of CO2. I mean, that's not really a thing, is it?
We can't do that.
Well,
they've set emissions targets and temperature targets. You know, back in 1992, before we had any understanding of any of this, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change had a treaty which 196 countries signed, including the U.S., to prevent dangerous anthropogenic climate change. And the way we do this is by eliminating emissions from fossil fuels. And this is back in 1992, before we had any evidence that there was warming being caused by humans. And, you know, we had very little understanding. But we already had this policy in place decades before we had any credible understanding of what was going on. So we've had the policy cart way out in front of the scientific horse from the very beginning. And the whole notion of dangerous, which is central to the UN treaty, they never really gave a definition. And it wasn't until 2010 that they decided that the definition of dangerous was 2 degrees of warming relative to pre-industrial times. Okay, and that was a political decision. The UN climate assessment, the IPCC, was not involved in that decision, but it was a political decision that was designed to provide, you know, maximum political pressure to reduce CO2 emissions. I mean, you know, think about, okay, since pre-industrial times, we've already warmed by 1.2 degrees centigrade. I hate to use centigrade. I know people in the U.S. think Fahrenheit, but to get degrees Fahrenheit, just double it. All of the climate treaties and everything is done in terms of centigrade or Celsius. So 2 degrees, we've already warmed 1.2 degrees, and the reference point was really at the end of the Little Ice Age, which was the coldest period of the millennium. Okay, they were, you know, George Washington, think Valley Forge and the terribly cold, crazy winters in Europe. There were famines, crazy cold weather and drought, you know, and big famines, and they were drowning witches because they were blaming them for the bad weather. I mean, thinking that that pre-industrial weather was some kind of a nirvana is basically a big joke. But apart from that, for the past, you know, 150 years where we've warmed 1.2 degrees, I mean, humans have made amazing progress. Technological progress, population has increased incredibly, and there's a far fewer number of people who are in poverty and who are exposed to, you know, severe food shortages. The deaths from extreme weather events and climate events, hurricanes, whatever, you know, have dropped by 97%, you know, in the last 100 years. Agricultural productivity has increased by leaps and bounds. So, you know, we've been doing really well, you know,
yeah,
either because of the warming or in spite of the warming, I couldn't tell you, but we're doing just fine.
Well, you know, we also learned in sixth grade that CO2 makes plants grow.
Exactly.
Still true, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the, and all of, any positive impacts of warming or increasing CO2 are completely ignored. One of them is that there's global greening.
Oh, yeah.
You hear about that. For the past 30 years, satellite observations show that, you know, the globe is greening. So this means plants uptake more CO2, which helps, you know, us manage the CO2 issue. it helps the agricultural productivity also. I mean, other good things about warming, I mean, there's, you know, I find it sort of comical when, like, Montana and Canada are worried about warming.
Yeah, right.
You folks would
North Dakota.
A lot better off. Yeah, North Dakota with some warmer temperatures. I mean, Siberia, northern China, Canada, and the Great Plains states in the U.S. would all do better with warmer temperatures, and this is sort of forgot. In the U.S., people hate cold winters, which is why we see people leaving. Well, one reason we see people leaving New York and Illinois, cold states, and moving to warm states like Florida and Texas and Arizona. So people don't like the cold weather. So, you know, this whole notion that warmer temperatures are, you know, absolutely dangerous, you know, is really the weakest part of their whole argument.
I look at these guys and it's got to be kind of embarrassing. I mean, when we were kids in school, they were telling us we were all going to freeze to death because it was the ice age coming, and then it changed. When we come back, we've got to take a really quick break, but when we come back, I don't want to skip the part about how the IPCC has multiple parts. I think the public basically believes it's all one big thing. And it actually isn't, and that was interesting. I didn't know that either, and I don't assume anybody else does. So let's make sure we work that in as we go. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
And I wonder if I'm really with you now. Just chasing after some finer day. Anticipation is making me late. It's keeping me
said if you ever need some music for your book. Love to be blinded by actual science. Okay, so Bill's been percolating a question over here.
Yeah, I Dr. Curry, I was just curious. You know, we talk about human-caused CO2. What is, I don't know if you know the numbers, but how much CO2 that we deal with on a daily basis is human-caused versus natural, like from volcanoes and that sort of thing. I know we just here in the last, I think, year or two ago, there was a huge volcano that erupted, I think, somewhere around Tonga that was really underreported.
Yeah, Tonga. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was supposed to, like, have an effect as far as cooling the planet for, like, 5 years. And that was really underreported. So how big of impact is the natural cause CO2?
Okay, well, if you read the IPCC, you know, all of the increase in carbon dioxide is caused by humans. But that is disputed by some scientists. I mean, the land and the oceans have a complex carbon dioxide cycle. So the amount in play from humans is a small fraction of the natural variability. But according to the IPCC, the idea is that the natural part of this is in equilibrium, whereas the human part is the part that's causing the increase. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's lots of different sources of carbon dioxide. But the idea, and the perturbation from Hanga Tonga is interesting. There was some CO2. Usually volcanoes have a cooling effect because they emit sulfate particles into the stratosphere. Well, Hanga Tonga emitted only a small amount of sulfate particles into the stratosphere, but a lot of water vapor into the stratosphere.
Oh, okay.
So Hanga Tonga is actually having a warming effect on the planet in the winter hemisphere. So this is something that's pretty unusual from Hanga Tonga. But the point is there's a lot of natural climate variability going on. And there's actually a blog post on my blog, Climate Etc., judithcurry.com, that's currently discussing a controversial new paper that plays down the human impact on the global carbon dioxide budget. So, I mean, this is still something. The IPCC would not have you think that there's any disagreement, but there clearly is some different ways of looking at this whole thing and a lot of things that we don't know.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, this is just another classic example of the amount of variables we have that are going to affect our climate, which really makes me question a lot of these climate models. I mean, how can they come up with these predictions, you know, in the next 12 years we're all gonna, you know, fry or freeze or whatever it is, when we really don't know a lot of these variables until they happen. So I don't know, how do they create these models with these predictions?
See, Chapter 7 of my new book goes into this in quite some detail. But the point is, these are complex models that include a lot of processes, atmosphere and ocean circulations, things like that. But things like volcanic eruptions or solar variability, that has to be specified.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just making assumptions that, you know, it's going to continue the way it has been, which is not necessarily a good assumption.
Right.
The other thing that these models don't do very well is they don't simulate the large-scale, long-term ocean circulations, which have a big influence on not just surface temperature, but on, you know, actual weather and climate conditions. And the models don't do a good job at that. So basically what the climate models do is show sensitivity to increasing carbon dioxide, you know, how much warming you would expect from increasing carbon dioxide. Now, that's obviously only one part of the climate puzzle. And even this response, the so-called sensitivity of global surface temperature to increasing carbon dioxide, has a factor of 300% uncertainty.
Uh-huh.
And this is acknowledged by the UN climate assessments, the IPCC. So there's, you know, a great deal of uncertainty in all this. And thinking that we can, you know, make specific predictions that will exceed this temperature in 2050, or we can only afford this much more emissions. I mean, this is based on, you know, very inadequate climate models.
And
lots of fear.
And it kind of gets back to what you were going to talk about earlier about the political side of the IPCC and our rush to make these radical responses to the climate when we really don't know what our future effects are going to be, but yet we want to make these.
Well, it's even worse. It's not that we don't want to know. It's that we won't let anyone explore it, because if you do, then you're bad.
Yeah.
And so how are you ever going to figure anything out if everybody, you know, anybody who's trying to get more information you know, gets a bag thrown over their head and thrown into the back of a trunk. I mean, that's not really all that helpful. So for those of us that are IPCC dumb, okay, so it's the International Panel on Climate Change. I think we've all had that thrown in our face quite a bit over the last, you know, decade. But I think most people, because they always talk about how all of the scientists at the IPCC are in a consensus of yada, yada, yada. But by watching your videos, I realize there are multiple parts of that organization. And there is some actual science. Can you kind of sketch the layout of that a little bit?
Okay. The IPCC works for the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Again, that's the UN organization that does the treaties, the Paris agreements, and so on. Okay, so on the IPCC's first report was published in 1990, and they've recently published their sixth assessment report. So there's three working groups in the IPCC. The first one is the physical basis. The second one is impacts and adaptation. And the third one is mitigation. So the sciencey part is part one. Okay, the sixth assessment report, which working group one, which was published in 2021, it was a pretty good report. It was certainly better than the fifth and the fourth assessment reports and the third assessment report. But you have to dig deep in the bowels to get the really good information. If you just read the summary for policymakers, now each of these reports has a summary for policymakers, and these summaries are written in collaboration with policymakers during a week-long meeting where the IPCC presents findings and then the summary for policymakers want this or that emphasized, this or that changed, and so forth and so on. So the summary for policymakers has a lot of cherry picking and a lot of spin, okay, yeah, relative to what was in the bowels of the report. And so you've got this spun summary for policymakers, and then UN officials start hyping it up, calling code red and existential threat and whatever crazy things, and then the media, you know, take it from there. Okay, and so what the public consumes is a bunch of alarmist spin. Okay, back to the other working groups, working groups two and working groups three. Okay, working group two relates to impacts and adaptation. Now, the fifth assessment report, the working group two report, was quite good. All right. Yeah, there was spin in the summary for policymakers, but I think they did their job really well. Not the case for the sixth assessment report. They viewed the whole exercise as trying to develop a rationale for urgently reducing fossil fuels, and they even stated that in their conclusion. So they didn't do their job right at all.
They didn't do the science and then come up with a conclusion. They came up with a conclusion backed the science in.
Well, a lot of the science, you know, that was established in working group one, they got it wrong in working group two, saying that there was an increase in this or that when working group one didn't find one.
Oh.
So, I mean, there was a lot of inconsistent science, but most of it they were just trying to, it was clear that they were trying to provide a rationale for rapidly reducing fossil fuels rather than doing their job and talking about impacts and adaptation. Okay. So that's working group two. Now, working group three. Working group three in the fifth assessment report, again, wasn't too bad, but again, they did their whole report without apparently having been aware of what working group one was writing.
Wow.
So they went off in a direction that was not really consistent with working group one, so that's sort of a problem. And one of the key conclusions of the fifth assessment working group three was that, you know, most of the problems, you know, are not so much related to climate change, but to poverty and poor governance. Okay.
Whoops. Okay. That's that awkward.
And that was in the summary, the first draft of the summary for policymakers. But when the final version didn't include that, you know, because the policymakers didn't like it, and they had a more conventional gloom and doom message about we need to reduce emissions.
Yeah, we need to get back to the narrative here.
Yeah, right.
So a lot of this depends on, you know, who is assigned to be lead authors on these IPCC reports, and this is a very political issue. Countries nominate people, and then the IPCC nominates further people, and then they pick who they want. So it's people with my kind of perspective don't get invited to serve on the IPCC. I mean, that they have to give a report that the UN framework, the UN climate negotiators want, otherwise they'll be put out of business. I mean, that's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
There's this chicken and egg situation where you've got really policy-driven science more than science-driven policy.
Yeah, which is a huge violation of the whole concept.
Right. So these assessments, I mean, they are authoritative, but they're very politicized. And given that, there needs to be space for people to challenge, to disagree, but that they try to ignore all that, that they put it open for review. And I know a lot of scientists who painstakingly go through this and send in comments, you know, this is incorrect, this needs to be included, whatever. And invariably, they're always ignored. So you know, the whole idea of this extensive peer review, scientific review of these reports is rather a joke. But that, you know, the Working Group 1 report, you know, at least for the IPCC 6 assessment report, you know, is fairly solid. If you ignore the summary for policymakers, the worst thing that happened with the 6 assessment report is that there's a 4th report. There's a synthesis report where they take all the highlights and put it into more of a summary report, and they really spun that in a political way, in a way that I've never seen before in that synthesis report. So this whole thing is just getting more and more politicized.
Wow.
The IPCC, you know, so it's bad. You know, it's a bad situation, and it's bad because the national funding agencies, you know, in the U.S., this would be, you know, National Science Foundation, NOAA, Department of Energy, whatever. They're funding research that supports IPCC objectives. Okay. Spend a lot of money on developing climate models, and they support regional climate assessments about the dangers of human-caused climate change and whatever. And all those announcements presuppose a certain direction for all of this.
Right.
You know, that climate models rule and that we're looking for dangerous human-caused climate change. So, you know, anything else is completely marginalized and isn't going to get funding from federal funding agencies.
See, and I think that's become kind of clear. I think even people who don't work in that industry have noticed that. I mean, even our local policy stuff, especially in California. I mean, if you want to get money for a project, you've got to somehow get some sort of climate change. Link. I guess you've got to somehow work that into what it is you're doing. Otherwise, you're persona non grata.
For sure. Even in, you know, the National Institute of Health, you know, I have friends, colleagues who work in public health, and they say the secret to getting any money from the National Institute of Health is to put some sort of climate change spin on it. Okay.
Wow.
So the National Institute of Health is throwing all this money at the health impacts of climate change, which are very difficult to discern, you know, and you have to wonder, you know, with all that money going in that direction, that we were ill prepared for the pandemic.
Yeah. I wonder why. Yeah. Well, besides, you know, the corruption, corruption and everything else. So you got to factor that in.
Yeah. So the World Health Organization in 2018 made this statement, something like that. Climate change is the greatest threat to public health, to global public health.
Oh, I remember when they did that. Yeah.
Century. Uh-huh. Well, maybe the pandemic was a whole lot worse.
Yeah, no kidding.
Know, in short years.
Maybe we could handle the weather after all. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
We have to take a really quick break again. Gosh, Judith.
Okay, now speaking of weather.
We're going to have to talk to you about a million times. We have to take a really fast break, but we're going to be right back. Our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, is our hostage for the rest of the program, so don't worry. We've still got tons of stuff that we're going to learn from her. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Now here we have two real pioneers embarking upon a new career, capitalizing on this global warming hype. Yeah, they're the ones that brought you the left-handed hammer and tried to market a recycled pamper. You could say the Gullible brothers have always been the entrepreneurial type. But this next harebrained Gullible venture could be earmarked as the major clincher as to whether or not they'll be living it up in their retirement age. They put all they had into one bankroll, bought a bunch of land down at the South Pole, eagerly awaiting the impending doom of climate change, thereby being in the catbird seat in the new Florida. And I'm all for working hard to keep this planet clean, but man-made global warming just don't make no sense to me. But if you insist on buying into this media false alarm, I know a couple of guys who wheel and deal in frozen farms.
Had to throw a little Ray Stevens Global Warming song in there. I just want to say Dr. Curry did not choose the music. That's our fault. So if you're going to blame somebody, you can go ahead and blame us.
just before the break, we kind of interrupted our thought on the weather.
Yes.
And I guess
the alarm about global warming in the public's mind is related to bad weather, okay, extreme weather. The most recent event is the crazy flooding in New York City, you know, that happened, you know, like 2 days ago, you know, just crazy flooding. Oh, my God, insane global warming. Well, Central Park in New York City has rainfall records back to 1856. And if you look at those rainfall records, last week's event ranks number 9th in terms of worst event, you know, over the last 160 years or so. So, you know, back in the 1880s and stuff like that, there were really bad events. Back in 1910, there were really bad events, and these had nothing to do with carbon dioxide. So the point is, if you look back to the first half of the 20th century or back to the 18th century where there's some weather data, invariably you find worse weather events that you cannot in any way blame them on CO2 emissions. So if you take the extreme weather, bad weather, out of the equation, what you're left with is the slow creep of warming and the impact on sea level rise and slow melting of glaciers. I mean, that's what we're talking about. And those are very slow processes. In spite of the alarming scenarios that some people have tried to paint, by using extremely implausible emission scenario and extreme amounts of warming and completely uncertain and poorly known processes that might cause the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet or something that would be in an impact in the 22nd or 23rd centuries. Okay,
yeah.
So this
yeah.
is what we're talking about in terms of, you know, possible adverse impacts from global warming. We're talking about the slow creep of sea level rise, pretty much, you know, which we can adapt to. So it's very hard. But like I said before, this whole issue, whether warming is dangerous, is the weakest part of their argument. And by relying on extreme weather events, they're in very shaky territory, because extreme weather events are dominated by the large-scale, multi-decadal ocean oscillation patterns and the associated atmospheric circulation. We've been in a bad spell since 2017, the warm phase of the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation, the cool phase of the Pacific decadal oscillation, those things that combine, you know, to give bad weather, particularly in North America and Europe. Now, that's going to flip at some point, you know, time scale of a decade probably, and then we're going to see a period of relatively benign weather. And we'll cycle back again and see periods of bad weather. I mean, this is just how weather works. And blaming all of this on human-caused warming, fossil-fueled warming, I mean, it's just fallacious.
No, there was a photograph, and I don't know, I don't remember the exact year, but I believe it was in the 1850s, 1860s. But there was a picture of the East River and some walls, some brick walls that were showing the level of the river. And that was like 100 years ago. And it's.
Okay. Is this in California?
No, I think it was in New York.
Okay.
And the actual ocean level hadn't risen significantly at all in this last 100
yeah,
years.
Yeah, I do remember that. I don't remember where that.
But
yeah,
they you know
well,
they,
look at this. Yeah, it's been a slow creep. You
yeah.
know, it's been less than a foot. You know, more like 8 inches, something like that. That's pretty small. You know, and you're trying to, you know, with ocean waves and tides, I mean, that kind of increases in the noise that we've seen so far. Now, when you mentioned like 1860 or something, I immediately keyed on the incredible atmospheric river events that occurred during winter of 1861 to 1862, when most of Central California was under 10 feet of water. That lasted for a couple of months. I mean, you know,
wow.
That's much, you know, that's like a really, really bad one. You know, nothing like what we even saw, you know, way worse than anything we saw last year or in recent
yeah,
memory.
But again, it was an event. Yeah, it was a singular event that you can't pin the a cycle on, really.
No, it's just saying that really bad weather has happened in the past, even worse weather has happened in the past that clearly had nothing to do with CO2 emissions.
Yeah. I always, the extreme weather events, you know, when they say, oh, we've never had this much, you know, snow, we've never had this much whatever. Well, when I was a kid, I lived in Connecticut, and I remember it must have been really early 1970s, and they had massive flooding. One, it was fall, wasn't winter yet, but it was fall. And I remember we were kids. It was fun. It's big time fun, actually. We were diving off of cars that were parked in the street. The water was up over the cars, and we had to take the canoes from our neighbor who was the Boy Scout regional guy. He had a bunch of canoes in his garage. So we got to take the canoes and canoe all the businessmen from the bus stops down to their houses. It was a fine money making opportunity for a child. I've never forgotten it. But you know, they say we've never had these things. Well, I guarantee you, nobody had an SUV when I was a kid. So all this stuff that supposedly caused all this, I haven't seen any of that happen since then. We shoveled a lot more snow back then, too. They have not had anywhere near the snow we had way back then.
No, for sure. Flooding's a big issue. Now, going back to the New York flood, I was just reading an article this morning where some city official was, you know, he was asked in an interview, well, you need to fix the sewers, you know, so the sewers can handle all this.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So, you know, to fix these storm sewers, we would have to dig up all the streets in the city of New York, and this would cost a couple $1 billion. Well, duh. And you think it's better to spend $1 trillion getting rid of fossil fuel plants and putting in, you know,
that are ultimately going to have no impact.
Exactly. So spend your $1 billion and fix the storm sewers. And it's not just, it doesn't have to, making sure they're clean. I mean, we have plenty of warning for this storm that it was going to be a major event. I remember I told my clients back on, I think last Tuesday, you know, expect, you know, up to six to eight inches. and that's pretty much how it played out. So there was plenty of warning. So can you please get out there and make sure all the sewers are clean, that they're not blocked by leaves or whatever debris? Okay, give people some warning to get their cars or stuff away so they're not interfering with the sewers. I mean, these are simple actions.
Yep.
That would improve the situation. Then you can do this before you even start thinking about digging up all the streets of New York City. But, you know, just blaming this stuff on climate change gives the politicians an out, you know.
Yeah, it's a reason to just lay there and do nothing, you know. You're just going to lie down because, well, there's nothing we can do anyway. It's climate change. And I wonder how much of that is actually orchestrated to prove, you know, as ways to show that, well, see,
well,
this is what we told you.
Well, I think it's at the city level, I think it's not orchestrated.
No, that's
that
just
way.
Kind of bad planning.
It's a really easy out, you know, cover your ass kind of thing.
Yeah.
Blame it on climate.
Yeah. Well, and out here, you know, every time we have a lightning strike, it's climate change. That's what cuts the trees on fire. You know, it doesn't matter that our forests are massively overstocked and, you know, we have all these forest management problems. It's all climate change. So if we all stop driving, but we didn't manage the forest, I guess lightning doesn't light trees on fire then. I mean, I guess by inference, right?
Yeah, it's just a very easy out for lazy politicians.
Yeah. I'm curious I guess this IPCC thing just still sticks in my craw because we're constantly bludgeoned by these guys and they are the experts driving the bus, you know? We've only got like a couple of minutes, but that's okay. We have you as our hostage, as I previously announced. We'll be able to go into the next hour, but in a perfect world, right, if the thing was run correctly, the working group one of the IPCC does the scientific research. Like they're the scientists. Is that kind of the idea?
Right. Yeah.
So they've got like, this is what we discovered. Here it all is. And then working group two, do they take that data and then run it through what, another filter of some sort?
Well, no, the working groups operate concurrently.
Oh, they do?
So by
time,
yeah, they operate concurrently.
Just with, like, different missions or something? So you got the scientist guys in one. Who's running two?
Yeah. Well, you've got other people who specialize on impact. You've got economists and whatever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then mitigation. So you don't have full consistency across the reports. You know, they should stagger it so that the working group one report is completed a year or two before working group two and working group three is completed.
Oh my gosh, no wonder it doesn't make any sense. That even makes less sense. And then the third group is kind of the politics spin guys, where we're going to take away everybody's cars and fine everybody for climate change and yada yada yada.
It tells you how to meet the net zero target, you know, without doing a full a proper cost benefit analysis of whether this makes any sense at all.
Wow, bizarre. All right, we've got to break for the news. We'll see what they have to tell us, and we'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People Radio. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape Machinery will take care of all your John Deere needs, from big tractors to little tractors to lawnmowers to riders to zero turns, implements, you name it. If it's green, they've got it up there. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard, in the city of Shasta Lake. They've got some pretty good financing going on right now if you're interested in that. Or you can give them a call, and their phone number is 530-226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. And that's PAPEmachinery.com.
Ta-da! Deceptively simple, but often confused. All right. So our guest this hour is Dr. Judith Curry. She was with us the first hour, and if you missed that, the commercial-free archive will be up this afternoon. Today is October 1st, 2023, when we're airing this originally. And Dr. Curry is the president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She's a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Let's see, I got to move this little icon here because I can't read it, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and prediction and predictability. She's a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. She has written a snazzy book that we have not had a chance to read yet, but we will. And we will talk about the book, or we'll force her to come on with us again just to talk about the book. That would be good. Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. Huh, what a clever idea. And I think we'd be rethinking the response because, I don't know, she'd be looking at actual science. This show will be very confusing for all the global warming believers, but for all of us who have been marginalized as global warming deniers, we finally found someone that can explain why we think destroying the world to change the weather makes no sense. Like, thank God, at least somebody's finally piping up. Dr. Curry, are you all alone out there? I know there are others, but is it a lonely place out on the when you're forced to walk the plank and be the climate denier?
Not at all.
Nice.
Although I have to say, a lot of people have left their university positions because it's pretty hostile if you have a different perspective. There are many who are in the private sector, who are in think tanks or non-governmental organizations, or who are retired or otherwise independent spokespersons, And through my blog, Climate Etc., I've developed a network of such people all over the world from many different professions, not just climate science, but lawyers, electric utilities, engineers, social psychologists, social scientists, economists, computer science experts, artificial intelligence people, you know, people from all over the world in the private sector, universities, and in non-governmental organizations. So there's quite a community of people out there with this perspective that UN officials, President Biden, and most of the social media are trying to silence. God bless Elon Musk.
Yeah, no kidding. It's funny that you say that because I was looking at a couple of your Twitter posts and it's like, seriously, people, come on. You're a denier. Really? Is that what you, that's what you bring to the table? Like, and you're refuting her information based on, yes, nothing. So I'm kind of curious, why do you, it kind of seems like there might be more people leaving the reservation, as they say, and diverging from the official narrative. What's driving it, do you think? Just frustration?
Frustration, their personal honesty and integrity. They don't want to play the game that you need to play in order to get ahead in university, academic life. And, you know, people who are concerned about the future and the way they see things going as we're destroying our energy infrastructure, destroying our economy and so forth and so on. And, you know, they're worried.
Yeah. They figured out they're going to live on the planet. They better, you know, they better make sure these guys don't implode it. The scary part of that, though, is as these people leave academia, I mean, on the one hand, I'm applauding. I'm thinking, good for you, you know. Stick to the science and don't be controlled. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, oh no, now the only people teaching our students are guys who have swallowed this stuff hook, line, and sinker, or are willing to just be, you know, amazing liars.
Well, and then also too, if you look at all the peer-reviewed papers that are being written, this is who's writing them, and you can't get published in those papers unless you.
Yeah, that's true, and they're peer-reviewing each other.
Toe the line.
Yeah, okay, back in the 70s and 80s, there was no such thing as climate science or climate studies. I mean, if you were sort of interested in this, you would get your degree in atmospheric science, geology, or oceanography.
Okay.
You know, these are the hard sciences that help you understand how the climate system works. Okay, nowadays, you have, I mean, even in the last 10 years, there's been an explosion of programs in universities that are broadly defined as climate studies. And they're very soft core when it comes to the science. I mean, they're not learning any real climate science. They're learning how to recite IPCC talking points, and then they're learning about how to use climate models to spin alarming impacts. They're learning communications, politics, and policy science, and there's very few places anymore where you can go to get a good, thorough foundation in the core sciences of atmospheric science, oceanography, and geology. So it's all being softened down in a rather ridiculous way, and.
Well, that'll hurt us long term too. I mean, obviously,
sure. And
creating a brain drain.
You've had activists, you know, going to get degrees, you know, in this topic, and then as they get tenure or whatever, they gain control, you know, and so you've got all this. Right now, you've got the whole academic community in climate science, broadly defined, is filled with activists. And there was a survey, and this just blew me away, I read this maybe a month ago. There was a published survey of a bunch of academic people that worked in climate science, broadly defined, and about 70% were in favor of degrowth, not just green growth, but in favor of actual degrowth, you know, population reductions, you know, restrictions, wealth and what people could do. And they just wanted to see degrowth. And to me, that is absolutely astonishing because the U.S. population is sort of 90% in favor of growth. You know, the degrowth growthers are quite a small number in terms of the overall U.S. population. But the degrowthers dominate at the university. And, you know, I don't know how you get past this because you've got this whole community of activist academic people that are teaching the next generation. And so how do you break that logjam? I don't know. You just need to make the field a lot smaller and stop funding it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, just stop the research grants and people will come to their senses. I don't know how you get out of that.
Yeah, stop feeding the beast. It will die.
To some extent, yeah.
Yeah. It's just got to be really disheartening as a scientist, honestly. I understand there's always, you know, there's always politics involved in all of these things because it's in everything. I mean, it's in family dynamics. It's in elementary school. I mean, it's not a new idea. But that seems to be really driving this. And it's fear and control, or control and fear. I'm not sure which comes first, probably the fear, I guess. When did that really become a thing? Like, when did that really sort of, when did you wake up and kind of go, okay, hold on, when did we get this?
Okay, well, I looked into this, and I talk about this in part one of my book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk. You have to go back to the 1980s and the UN Environmental Program. Again, and this is definitely a degrowth, anti-capitalist, anti-democratic organization, and they were, you know, looking for a cause that would help promote UN non-governmental control. They hate the oil industry and the fossil fuel industry. And so that they latched onto the climate change issue. Okay, this is our ticket. Okay, and it was, they set all this into play, and, you know, we're behind, you know, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Remember the 1992 treaty?
Oh, yeah.
Precautionary principle, this is what saved the day. We don't need scientific uncertainty. You know, if there's, you know, any conceivable threat, we can just go do this. You know, that was their rationale.
Wow.
So the precautionary principle was a big part of what drove this into, you know, international policymaking. So it was, you know, a clear degrowth kind of political agenda. That was latched onto the climate change problem issue and used a precautionary principle to justify all this. Okay, this is absolutely stupid and naive basis for policymaking. Okay, but somehow it is still, you know, still carrying the day. All these targets and emissions and temperature targets are, you know, rationalized by the precautionary principle. But what my book does, and this is really in part three of the book, as it goes through and talks about what, you know, how should we think about the risks from climate change? And there are some, and there's benefits to climate change, but we need to be honest and clearly assess all this, and we need to consider plausible worst cases. We need to, you know, really understand the risks and the benefits in a rational way. And in terms of managing all this, you know, we can't control the climate. This whole idea of these targets and emissions targets and everything are based on the idea that we can control the climate. We can't. We need to disabuse ourselves of the notion that we can, that carbon dioxide is some kind of a climate control knob. It most definitely is not. Okay, so we need to, once we disabuse ourselves the notion that we can control it, then we have to figure out how to better understand it and how to manage the risks. Okay, so, you know, all of this is laid out in my book about how we should think about this and how we should approach this. And there's, you know, in 21st century risk science, there's a lot of good ideas and decision-making uncertainty, lots of ideas and frameworks that aren't being brought to bear on the climate change problem. We're locked into this silliness with the targets, you know, and,
right.
you know, we have
until we've met the targets, we haven't done our job. Therefore, we can't mitigate any of this because we didn't hit our targets, even though the targets scientifically don't move the needle. It's like it's a sad, defeating little loop.
Yeah. Now, there's another thing I have to point out, and maybe I should have made this point earlier, but a lot of the alarm is tied to an extreme emission scenario, the so-called 8.5 emission scenarios. And this is where you get, you know, all of the papers, you know, that say, you know, all these alarming impacts possible by 21, they're tied to this extreme emission scenario. And the IPCC, most of what they do is tied to this extreme emission scenario. Well, around 2016, I started reading some papers saying that these extreme emission scenarios are completely implausible. They rely on, you know, increasing our coal burning by 600%, you know, and stuff like that. It makes no sense. Okay. And, you know, and I was writing on this on my blog, you know, this is an implausible scenario, and people were publishing it, and I was trying to highlight these papers. You know, it was like screaming into the void. But someone was paying attention because in 2021, the UN Conference of Parties, their, you know, annual, you know, report that they do, they dropped considerations of these extreme emission scenario, and we're working from the medium emission scenario. And this was done without any fanfare. And ever since then, you know, in the 2022 one, this was also dropped. So the UN has dropped consideration of these extreme emission scenarios. But even the sixth assessment report, the IPCC, relied heavily on these 8.5 scenarios, even though they mentioned a couple times that some people think these emission scenarios are implausible. Well, there's a long time horizon for these reports, so you can sort of understand that. But when it came to do the synthesis report, which was published in 20, or even just, you know, within the last year, they still relied heavily on these extreme 8.5 emission scenarios, which are totally implausible, if not impossible. So there's this huge time lag, you know, in terms of, you know, now the UN is out in front of the IPCC in the right way in terms of saying, okay, these are stupid scenarios we need.
That's terrifying. The UN is going
to
save us.
Realistic one. Yeah.
And wow.
So the IPCC is off in la-la land. And scientific papers still continue to be published using these 8.5 emission scenarios, not just get published, but the mainstream media picks them up and hypes the alarm. You know, we're not going to have any water. We're going to have...
And that's where they're pushing all of this terrible policy. Oh my gosh! Okay, hold that thought. We've got more on this topic to discuss with Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm gonna do bad things, do it like it's nothing. Being bad has never felt so good. Doing bad things to you. Mama always told me that I should play nice, but she didn't know you, and she gave me that advice. Yeah, I'm through with you. You're one bridge I like to burn. Scatter the ashes, smash the iron. I'm through with you. La-di-da. I don't want to be your chest for fun. Don't want to be under your thumb.
shout out to all the people who have left the evil climate change swirling suction of money and branched out on their own. So, Dr. Curry, before we bury the lead, it's not lucrative when you do that, though, is it? Like when you?
No. My company, among its clients, includes some people in the energy sector, a number of electric utilities, and even two what I would call petroleum companies. Okay, and people say, oh, my gosh, he's in the pay of fossil fuel. But they don't provide donations. I mean, I provide services to them, hurricane forecast, temperature forecast, wind energy forecast, so they can help make decisions about how much energy to allocate and how to prepare for
sure.
Severe weather, all this kind of thing.
Yeah, they're not like your new Santa.
Yeah, right. And the other thing is, in the private sector, I had a cushy salary when I was at Georgia Tech. And in the private sector, I have never come close to making what I did when I was at Georgia Tech. So I took a financial loss. I'm doing fine, but I'm not making any money off of doing this or, helping insurance companies and municipalities and energy companies make better decisions and better understand their weather and climate related risk. And when people say, oh, you shouldn't work for oil companies, excuse me, weather and climate information are a public good.
Yeah, no kidding.
You should be providing it to don't you want the energy companies and electric utilities to have the best possible information to make their decisions? And what kind of advantage do you think they gain by using bad information
exactly.
and making bad decisions? So, I find that whole canard really infuriating.
When you
when
you talk about hurricane predictions, recently we had a California style hurricane that hit Southern California. there was all
glad
this.
We weren't the only ones laughing.
Yeah, I mean, there was all this hype over we're going to get nailed by this massive hurricane. It's going to cause death and destruction and. Well, it never really happened. I mean, it was a bad storm, but it was a storm for crying out loud. I'm sure the people on the East Coast were laughing their butts off at us because, I mean, they have serious hurricanes back there. Who do we listen to when it comes to these hurricane? Like right now, they've got hurricane warnings for the East Coast. They're predicting these hurricanes that are way out in the Atlantic coming on shore and wreaking havoc. Is there a place to go or somebody we should be listening to that has better information or more accurate information than what we're getting?
Okay. Ever since Hurricane Katrina, there's just been this extreme hype about hurricanes because people figure that people are more afraid of hurricanes than anything.
Oh, there you go.
That's
true.
Yeah, and so hurricanes get hyped in a crazy mm-hmm. way. But there's a number of people on Substack who are writing good newsletters about weather and particular hurricanes. Three that come immediately to mind are the Eyewall. Another one is Michael Lowry. And then Ryan Maui. I mean, these are three credible sources that you can, get mostly for free. But if you, pay a nominal you can get additional information, but those are really good, credible sources, people who have advanced degrees in meteorology, really understand hurricanes and weather. I make specialized forecasts to my clients. I have about 100 people on my mailing list. These are paying customers of my clients, and what I bring to the table is I make better long-range forecasts and also more detailed landfall impact forecasts. So, people on my mailing list are mostly people in the insurance sector, some in the energy sector, and even some in, building construction and more project kind of management kind of thing. So there are sources out there that are very reliable. even like the Weather Channel. The Weather Channel is pretty reliable, but they hype it up a bit. But they're pretty reliable on the Weather Channel. So there is good information out there, but, you know, there is tons of silliness in the media, particularly when it comes to a hurricane.
Boy, no kidding.
Yeah, I remember I had a meteorology professor back in late 70s, and this poor guy, he's probably been institutionalized since. It was when the news was starting to blame the weather for things. It was kind of during that crossover period where this storm killed all these people, you know, and this guy he would just lose his mind. He's like, the weather never attacked anyone. It's the weather. Like, he was super frustrated by the blaming of the weather for all these things. I'm hoping he's no longer living. He wouldn't be able to make it through this whole thing. Weather blaming.
But it's every, you know, it's the heat wave, the cold wave.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, and the severe convection. You know, this year in the U.S., no fires. Minimal hurricane damage. You know what the hurricane losses have been? It's been severe convective storms, thunderstorms, flash floods, tornadoes. You know, and this is the first time that insurance losses have ever been dominated by these severe convective storms. And the IPCC says, you know, we have no reason to expect severe convective storms to worsen as a result of global warming. In the U.S., you know, the frequency of tornadoes has actually declined significantly over a number of decades. But nevertheless, you see this hyped up as being caused by global warming. So it's just an all-purpose cause that gets, I guess, lots of clicks for the media, lots of media attention for scientists who think this somehow helps their career. And at the end of the day, we're not really figuring out how we can deal with these risks in a sensible way.
Sure.
My company just got a grant from the NOAA under the Small Business Innovation Research Program, SBIR. Okay, the SBIR for companies does not have the political correctness concerns that the main, you know, government grants to universities does. So, you know, we have a grant working on figuring out how to use artificial intelligence to make better predictions of extreme weather events out to 6 days. So that's something that my company is working on, and we're very excited about this new project that the SBIR grant from NOAA is supporting. So stay tuned in a couple of years. Hopefully we will
nice.
See some better forecasts at longer time horizons.
Well, you know, you brought up all the insurance companies, and that's a big thing out here. I mean, we have lots of people who listen who don't live in California, but everybody has should be hearing because of our, you know, poor forest management out here, we've had a lot of really big fires that, of course, have been all attributed to global warming. And that has driven our insurance companies out of the state, that and some other bad policies
by
the state.
Okay. Now, I testified earlier this year before the Senate Budget Committee on insurance and climate change. And I looked into particularly what's going on in California, Louisiana, and
Perfect.
Florida. I'm very familiar with Florida because Florida Citizens Insurance, they're one of my clients. Okay, and now I looked at what California, and the big issue is the regulations on the insurance
yep.
industry. Okay, if you start capping what they can charge, then, you know, they're just going to pull out. Okay, if they charge what makes sense to them so they can stay in business, well, you have to pay. And, you know, year to year, they're going to go up and down as their perception of the risk, okay, changes. Now, in Florida, the issue is litigation, people suing the insurance companies. So the state is trying to get that under control, which will, you know, help the insurance companies think Florida's a little bit more friendly. But the point is, you know, there's all these new insurance mechanisms, insurance-linked securities, catastrophe bonds, all these mechanisms to help share risk, and they're great. Okay, but if the state governments start regulating all this, then the insurance companies don't want to play.
Yep.
Okay, so game over. Sorry, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
So you just need to let the market do its thing. And even, okay, I had a client, it was at one of the utilities in Florida, and they were trying to figure out the solar farms. Well, we need insurance for our solar farms against hurricanes. And they tried, and the insurance companies were trying to charge them an arm and a leg. And they said, this doesn't make sense. So we did a study for them, you know, to show, well, this is what we think the real risk is to your solar farms. And they decided to self-insure. The insurance companies were just charging too much. They had some misconceptions about, you know, what the real risk was to these solar farms. So they ended up self-insuring. And we'll see if that turns out to be the right decision, but I definitely think it is. So, I mean, there's some interesting dynamics in play with regards to insurance. And like all these new risk-sharing mechanisms that are coming online are really exciting and are going to help homeowners and property owners. But, okay, now, one person that I follow quite closely on this issue is an economist called Matthew Kahn. And his idea, if you get regions where there's a lot of risk, like, you know, Florida for hurricanes or California for fires, then it's going to make sense for investors to buy up a lot of properties, okay, and rent them out, and they can better figure out how to manage the financial risk and to make these properties more robust, you know, to whatever damage, and that it's going to be, you know, in these really vulnerable regions that you're going to see investors taking over the property and more rental. So the homeowners, you know, just don't have to deal with this whole issue of understanding the, you know, the hazard risk, making good decisions about insurance. And I think that probably makes a lot of sense as a way to proceed in really risky locations. But you just trying to regulate the insurance to keep prices down is not a good solution here.
No, they've driven them out. So between that one of my pet peeves is that they consistently refer to our fires out here as natural disasters. Like, nope, those are policy disasters all day long. Those are not natural
exactly.
Natural disasters. Those are tornadoes and hurricanes and things we can't control.
Right. You know, when many of them are set by arson and they burn really badly because of poor forest management. It's really hard to call them natural disasters.
Well, and we get a lot of lightning. I mean, just up the farthest northern county in the center of the state that borders Oregon, I can't even. They had 26 fires all started in roughly the same 1 week period from lightning, and that wasn't even all the lightning strikes.
Wow.
So, you know, you get that in heavily forested areas and, you know, cut back on the management, make it a little harder to get to them, and you're going to have some fire. But this idea that if we all live in the dark ages, we will stop that just makes no sense whatsoever. And I know you had commented in one of the videos that I was watching last night. We were watching, you were talking about the environmental footprint of like wind and solar and kind of the viability of that as a, I don't know, you didn't say replacement, but as a substitute type of a thing to fossil fuels. And I wonder, when we come back, could we chat about that just a tiny bit?
Oh, for sure.
Because I thought your perspective on that was really smart, and it's one of those things I think a lot of us have thought, but
that's a hot topic.
But
though.
We don't have anybody with any credentials that goes, yeah, you know what, that actually isn't a dumb idea. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry, and you are listening to us on We the People Radio.
.us.
What indeed? Well, you could listen to factual information. That would keep you from... maybe that would keep us from going crazy. Okay, so back to our topic at hand, Dr. Curry.
Okay, wind and solar. There's a whole lot of reasons. I'm not a fan of wind and solar farms. Rooftop solar is okay. Without going into detail, the push for wind and solar is the idea that they can be implemented rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we don't have to wait for new technology developments or the long time horizon that it takes to get a nuclear power plant in place. So the idea is wind and solar. It's free energy, it's readily available, let's go do it. Okay, a whole lot of reasons while that story doesn't quite work, but let's go back to the land use issue. The footprint, okay, if we were to replace all of our current fossil fuel usage generating with wind and solar power plants, it would use a huge amount of land, not just for the power generation, but for the transmission lines. Because the wind and solar is, by definition, it needs to be away from the population centers and mostly in the Great Plains states. You need a lot of transmission lines. Now, if you talk about, more than doubling the usage of electricity on the time scale of a few years, we need, even more. People are unrealistic about how much energy we're going to need in the future. Not just for developing world and to get electricity for Africa and stuff like that, but just in the United States. I mean, for things like, huge data centers and artificial intelligence and blockchain and whatever, these things are using enormous amounts of electricity, and their benefits to us are just only starting to be realized. So we're going to need a lot more electricity, and the land use footprint is huge. And you say, even the farmers, you say, just put it on farmland. Well, the farmers don't want it because it reduces the value of their land if they ever decide to sell their farmland for property development or whatever,
And who wants shade over their crops and or dead birds littered everywhere. I mean, either one of them come with a big downside.
Well, not only that, but it changes the microclimate. Okay, it dries out the soil, and it warms the surface temperature at night. Okay, so it's changing the microclimate. So, so farmers, don't like it. And I don't know what the latest count, but the latest count that I've seen is that over 500 wind farms proposals have been rejected by some combination of the local communities, local landowners, and enviro advocacy groups. They're just getting rejected. And the transmission line issue is you think that, well, that should be the simplest, but it's pretty insurmountable. Getting new transmission lines built in the U.S., I mean, it's been, you know, for the last two decades, it's been creeping along extremely slowly. Okay. And the idea of having this national grid, you know, with lines going everywhere in the U.S. from the base region, you know, in the Great Plains state, you know, is just, you know, a pipe dream. It's hugely expensive. But again, getting people to agree to this, who own the land, is a very difficult thing to do. So they're talking about eminent domain and all this kind of stuff. Once we start going there, I mean, this country will be up in arms, you know, trying to claim people's land to support wind energy, which is completely inadequate and unreliable, and it turns out to be very expensive. You know, the other solution, you know, if net zero or reducing CO2 emissions, is really geothermal and nuclear energy. Nuclear energy, you can fit nuclear power plants right into the same locations where you currently have coal power plants, and you have the transmission and everything all right there. That seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah, but how's that going as far as an idea to pitch?
No, it's growing. Nuclear is growing in support in leaps and bounds.
Nice.
Europeans, oh my gosh, you know, Japanese, South Koreans, Europeans, even in the U.S. I mean, this is where we're going. In the U.S., the biggest problem is all the permitting and regulatory stuff. It takes forever to get these things built, and the expenses, almost an order of magnitude inflated, owing to all the regulations. And these regulations need to be toned back because, you know, the new generation of nuclear power plants are so much safer and so much better designed that you just don't need all this crazy red tape. So hopefully that can get sorted out a bit. But in Japan and South Korea and Russia and China are building nuclear power plants like in 6 years. So it can be done. In the U.S., it can't be done within the current regulatory environment. The other thing that I see promise is geothermal energy, particularly in the U.S. West. And Colorado Governor Jared Polis is taking the lead in terms of coordinating with the other state governors to try to push these new technologies. I mean, this shows a lot of promise. Again, it's not as objectionable land use. It does take up some land. In my state, Nevada, Nevada Energy was looking to build a new geothermal power plant, but they ran into difficulties with the tribal land ownership, so they have to find a new location. So they have to work around the tribal land constraints, either that or make it very lucrative, you know, for those who own the tribal land. So they said, oh, yeah, we want this. It doesn't damage the land very much, and we can make a lot of money. So they have to figure out how to deal with that. But this is even better than hydropower. You know, it's not intermittent. It's not asynchronous, unlike wind and solar. I mean, and so it's really friendly to the grid.
And it doesn't use a bunch of, with wind and solar, I mean, you just have so many problems. Yeah, there's nowhere to put the blades of the wind power, the turbines. After they get done chopping up the birds, you've got to figure out what to do with the blades because they're not recyclable.
I know. There's tons of problems. And the absolute worst is the offshore Atlantic wind turbines and, you know, all the whales dying.
You know,
it's just unbelievable. And this is a kicker. In the 1970s, I mean, Greenpeace, you know, their big original mantra when they first came into business was save the whales.
Save the whales.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, who cares about the whales?
Yeah, they're silent on that issue now. Where's Greenpeace
now? Who cares about that? Well, same too with I mean, for heaven's sakes, you know, endangered species are only impressive unless they want to, like up here where we are, they want to take out the four Klamath dams. And so they've got these endangered species that, oops, 80% of the population lives behind the dams and the reservoirs. So the California legislature passed some legislation, said, well, they're not endangered during dam removal, so it's okay to kill them then. Like,
oh,
what? You can't kill them any other time, but if we're going to take out all your dams, yeah, I guess we're going to kill them then.
Yeah. And so this is the problem, that the whole climate change activism has totally left traditional environmental issues behind. You know, oh, they're not important. You know, who cares about all this stuff if, you know, if all of humanity's been destroyed or whatever, which is totally ridiculous. But, you know, the climate issue has displaced all of the traditional environmental concerns to the great detriment of our planet,
well,
in my opinion.
And I guess I'd even go farther. It's basically become a religion. I mean, in the absence of belief in a higher power, they have come to, you know, because, and you can tell by the verbiage, you know, don't you believe in climate change? It's like, no, I believe in God, but I'd like to follow science. I shouldn't have to believe in science. Science should be science. Like, I don't know when science started being a belief.
Jeez. There's a great new book out on that issue. I can't remember the title, but the author is Andy West. I think it's In the Grip of Culture, The Social Psychology of Climate Catastrophism.
Oh.
It's something like that. It's a really, really
good
book.
The second Great Witch Burning? Subtitle,
right.
AKA The Second Great Witch Burning.
Right. So he explains, like, the cultural drivers behind all this. It's a pretty good book. But, yeah, no, it's crazy. And if people, you know, so I grew up in the 50s and 60s, so I'm about 10 years older than you are. And at the time, the scare thing was, you know, the Russians and nuclear war. But,
I remember that.
That was a little bit more of a real, that was a little bit more of a real scare. Okay, so, you know, I don't know what hiding under our desks, you know, when a nuclear bomb exploded was really going to help. But we were all aware of it and we were all scared. But that was a little bit more of a real issue in climate change. And, but, you know, we eventually, you know, got over it and grew up. But what we're seeing with this climate issue is that it's just more long-term. And the messaging that goes out to children and young adults is far worse than, you know, what we see as adults even.
I think
this book targeted at 4 to 8-year-olds, Greta Thunberg's world.
Oh,
you know, why should Greta go to school when the world's going to end in 30 years? You know, all this kind of stuff. And this is fed to kids. And in curriculum in the U.S., you know, they're trying to turn all the students into climate activists. I mean, it's explicit in the National Education Association documents. I mean, it's just beyond crazy. So the kids are getting exposed to this. I mean, they're depressed, some even suicidal over this issue.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, all for what? They're living in the best of times. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, their future is very, very bright, you know, if they don't screw it up and if the adults in the room don't destroy the energy supply, you know, they're going to live.
Well,
know,
if we put scientists,
time.
Like if we put real science back in charge again and we start evaluating, remember we used to have to evaluate things and now, no, you must believe it or you are, you know, a heretic, et cetera, et cetera. And Andy West's book, I'm going to post, I'll post that on the page for today. It's called The Grip of Culture, The Social Psychology of Climate Change Catastrophism. And he's Andy West, like the ordinal, W-E-S-T. But I'll post that on the page because, I mean, just looking at the picture on the front, it tells me everything about the book. It's like, oh, holy crap. That is exactly what they're doing too, and it's when you have to scare people. I guess I reject anything where somebody's going to come after me with fear. You know, you should be able to win me over on logic. But when you have to scare me to do it, I start going, I don't know. I mean, are a lot of people put off by the fright, or have we just scared people about so much stuff that now everybody just runs willy-nilly sheep over the cliff?
Well, there's different personality types.
Oh, that's
true. Some are susceptible to this, and others call BS on it. You know, so it's... But the worst thing about it is trying to brainwash the kids. That's what I object to more than anything.
Yep. No, I would put in with you there, because that kind of thing, and that never turns out good. That's the thing. When you manipulate people like that, as soon as they look at what's happening now, you know, we've manipulated people with so many things. COVID's a good one. Could you imagine if we really did have something that was super scary and going to do everybody in, and everybody be like, oh, I'm calling BS on that one. We have to escape. Oh, my gosh. I cannot believe it. How did this happen? We still have so many questions, so little time. But we expect you to be our hostage again in the future. We hope you had a fun time, because we have a whole list of questions, and I think we asked like three of them, and there's more. But,
this is a great conversation, and you did ask really good questions.
Well, we're curious by nature, so you know we wanted to know. So we really appreciate you taking the time. We will have you on again. Hopefully soon. Our guest has been Dr. Judith Curry. You can find the archive later this afternoon at wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, they say the sea is rising. Well, that's all right with me, cause there ain't no other place than on the sea I'd rather be. And that second coming's coming, it's right around the bend. And someday could be any day, and this world is gonna end. But that's alright, that's okay. There ain't nothing we can do about the whole thing anyway. It's a hang-on kind of ride. We're spinning through space and time, rocking this big old rock, just trying to have some fun. So let's drink another beer. Here's to another year, let's take another crazy trip around the sun.